for me, the functional use value of negativity emerges out of necessity, rather than something that's like to be sold and embraced because it's going to help my life and improve. It's more of a necessity, of a kind of self-defense process in reaction to the brutality and violence of social systems that employ positive ideological production all the time. I do think it's helpful to introduce people to non-positive language and as a framework for critical thinking, and also then responding and organizing in critical ways. I think, like, you know, part of it is that it has to be entwined to a process of unpacking a lot of the optimism that's been embedded in people. And, you know, so for me, it's kind of related to issues of class consciousness and issues of social consciousness, as opposed to some sort of existential or transcendental consciousness, spiritual blah, blah consciousness. It's really, for me, about something that emerges out of social material struggles and a kind of inability to reconcile the dominant ideological framework with the dominant means of social interaction and social practices.
I wonder if you feel necessary to sort of stop where you are with your assessment of things, or do you take the time ever to just imagine or visualize what another world would look like where all of the things you're critiquing have sort of been somehow solved, or the oppression has been removed? Or do you just say, no, it's not even worth visualizing. It's never going to happen. We just need to exist.
It's certainly never going to happen. It's kind of like, actually, there was a project that Mark Fell and I did that sampled Tony Benn, the British labor organizer, Tony Benn, saying something to the effect of, basically, you know, like every generation has to face the same struggles, and there's no final victory and no final defeat. And I think that there is some accuracy to that. The idea of me projecting my desire for what I imagine the future, what a better future could be,
is not necessarily actually future too. It could just be a parallel. Like, what if history played out differently? Just as a mental experiment, even if you know that it would never happen, just to sort of conceptualize what that might look like.
Sure. I mean, of course, people fantasize.
Terry Thamlid, DJ Sprinkles, and Seth Horvitz, Eros, with us. And we're talking about pessimism and music.
Record is Payback by Cleveland, released on Hivern Records in 2017.
I don't want my dreams that are basically enslaved to my sufferings to be what future generations need to find themselves still kind of trapped and working around. You know, like I am not in a position to talk about the framework that other people, and even today, other people should be doing. All I'm interested in, and that all that I kind of feel the best I can do without being authoritarian and going into that kind of weird power position, is to simply try to catch up, do the best I can to kind of catch up to where we are today. So it's a kind of historical materialism that is not teleological and not invested in a kind of Marxist utopian future, any of that stuff. It's more about historical materialism in terms of understanding the social workings of how we come to internalize the mythologies of what we are as a culture, communally, individually, etc. And to just kind of see that as something that's going to be inherently flawed, inherently fictitious, inherently deceptive, inherently tied to systems of power that are abusive and violent. And so my interest personally is in divestments of power, and rather than power sharing, or like, which like LGBT pride and all that stuff is about, and most civil rights in the West are, most humanist civil rights movements are about power sharing. I'm interested in divestments of power. And that is a very different thing. Like, so like, so I think, like, you know, when you have the kind of humanist liberal tendency to be like, you know, like get on Twitter and start like sending out good vibes about like, hey, we need to come together to like put an end to violence against women. And then like, oh yeah, everybody's fucking donating money. And what's the plan? No fucking plan. But like, you know, that's a very different and very prosperous way of going about political organizing, as opposed to something that I think if we kind of get rid of the optimism and just identify the urgency of the moment, like, okay, like, look, like the amount of violence going on right now is unacceptable. And if we're reacting to what is unacceptable in the moment, as opposed to reacting to our desire for what we wish the world could be, I think that that has a very deep impact on how one organizes, how one approaches the issues and the problems and interactions with others. So that's why I try to get hope and all that shit out of the, like, leave that. That's all bullshit for the mainstream humanist liberal bullshitters. I'm interested in just trying to see if I can even identify what the urgencies and the most vile, urgent conditions are, like, because you can't even get, you know, if you kind of live by a kind of neoliberal, even just a fucking liberal mindset, you can't even get to that. You instantly got to go into like dreams of what you want shit to be like. Well, let's fucking deal with the fact that like people are fucking being beaten and raped right now. That's like, that's, I'm more interested in that rather than talking about like, hey, let's get to a world where people aren't being beaten and raped. No, let's fucking deal with the fact that people are being beaten and raped right now. That's for me is like a different, it has a different urgency. It has, it's going to direct your actions in a different way than optimism will.
But is it not possible to do both simultaneously?
The optimist would say yes. The optimist will always say yes.
So, but you think if just the intent to do both simultaneously prevents you from handling what's going on in the moment?
I think that the goal of reducing violence is different from the goal of generating a world without violence, because I think the latter is a fantasy. I think it's putting, you know, it's like investing yourself into an ideological production of something that could never be. The world is violent.
Well, what if you recognize there's an ideal that you will never reach, and yet you want to struggle to go towards it with the knowledge that you will never reach it, right? But you're still looking towards, you can still deal with the moment and deal with what's happening right now and changing the things that are unacceptable while maintaining a certain open-ended vision for what may come about.
I would say that's what most people do. And I would say, how's that working for us?
And so what you're saying is somehow if we stop thinking about any form of...
We won't be able to do that. It's not going to happen. People are going to keep thinking optimistically. People are going to keep investing. Like the mainstream dominant means of achieving civil rights, of addressing issues of violence and stuff, is always going to be this kind of liberal humanist, optimistic infested, pseudo-evangelical, secular humanist bullshit.
with Secrets, released on the Bank of New York just before the global plague hit the world. A very long time ago, Stendhal said that beauty is a promise of happiness. Sometime after, Dostoevsky's Idiot tragically showed that beauty can't save the world, that beauty can't even save itself.
What I'm talking about is not, it's not for everyone. It's not a solution. It's simply, again, going back, it's not an identity. It's a practice, and it's a minor practice, and it's in relation to specific situations on a specific minor sphere. And it's not about trying to globalize or humanize in terms of like a universal experience. It's in opposition to all that. It takes time for people to kind of find a necessity to step out of that and to kind of step away from positivity and optimism in their language and stuff. And it really is, you know, like a process. You have to, for me, it's like, I really think it's about the first step is just kind of like try getting through the day without saying positive things. And the result isn't that you, doesn't mean that, oh, then you're just gonna be bitching all day. No, what it means is that when you speak, and when you want to speak about something, even if it's a plus in your life, by using non-positive terminology, you're being more you're forcing yourself to think more specifically about what it is you actually want to convey. And I think that that's kind of you know, a helpful thing. It's be similar to like suggesting couples go through a week without saying "I love you," but not to withhold, not in a way that's about withholding affection, but about finding different language to express what they feel.
And sort of breaking these patterns, or just being aware of the patterns that we fall into.
Yes, because it's so much about pattern.
Very good. There was an important philosopher, Leo Pardi, who said that it is possible to have an unhappy and still excellent and outstanding life.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that always disappoints me about those kinds of quotes, though, is that, again, those are the quotes that people who aren't really, who are people who are still very much invested in a kind of optimistic outlook, that kind of quote appeals, because it is in the end selling it. It is kind of, it's using language that is comprehensible to, you don't have to have a certain kind of criticality to get what it's saying. And that is leading us away from this investigation into that other kind of criticality that I think has more use value. But
right. So to use the words outstanding and excellent, exactly, is again preaching the same optimism you're saying. But you can be negative and it can be great and it's positive. But then you just were positive. Right. So
right. So what happens if we understand what the gesture of that message is meant to be? And the question then becomes, how do we talk about that without falling back into the most, that easy, comfortable, quick to the tongue, you know, silver tongued optimistic rhetoric? And it takes a bit of effort, you know, like and for me that is about shifting to use value, shifting the idea of value to use value as opposed to fulfillment, because use value is grounded in the material.
Terry, if I try to rephrase it now, keeping in mind your correction, do you mind checking my logic a little bit?
An
unhappy life is life nonetheless.
There you go. that's a good start. Yeah, and that doesn't mean that life is necessarily good, but yeah, it's.
And Terry is located in Chiba Prefecture in Japan, but Seth is located in London.
I guess we can just say, to frame things too in terms of age, yeah, I'm 53 and grew up in the American Midwest and, you know, super Christian Bible Belt assholes and, you know, like the hypocrisies of that kind of environment quickly fills you in on, you know, either you join the cult or you see through it and you develop opposition to it. And And I was the latter, and that's kind of, you know, I guess how I arrived at seeing through the false promises and the deceptions of offering people hope. I mean, the main reason I came to Japan was for physical safety, personal safety. I mean, you know, I was 32 when I came to Japan, and I was still facing being called a faggot every time I left my house. And I was in Oakland, which is like near San Francisco, gay Mecca, blah, blah. And it's just, you know, the United States is just an aggressive shithole. And in Japan, there's also a lot of bias and sexism and homophobia and transphobia. But at least here, when they don't like you, they react by silence. You know, it's like they ice you out. And I understand that if you're born and raised here, that that is as painful as having somebody yell at you in the United States, for me. But from my experience, that silence is golden, as I always say. And I can deal with people who don't like me not talking to me. I've been living in Japan for 20 years, and I'm still incredibly mentally infected by the frameworks of thought and that were ingrained into me in my youth. And so, you know, that's kind of, I guess, one reason why I really appreciate being able to live outside the United States and to have a safe place in Japan, is because not because it allows me to transform into something else or the opening of the new mentality, but actually more importantly for me is about just unbecoming and stepping away from some of those really entrenched social patterns that of course are so specifically American, but at the same time so kind of naturalized as part of a universal human experience, that it's just really been helpful for me to be outside the West and here in Japan, not in terms of like, oh, I'm, you know, like now I'm like Japanese and all this romantic blah blah. No, it's just more like the typical immigrant path of getting away from what was unacceptable and hoping for something better where you go to, but not about following dreams or anything like that.
Yeah, wonderful. In many ways, what one could say that you know, your pessimism has led you to where you are right now, and I can certainly relate to that.
Sure, our outlooks also frame our sense of what options we are able to see or not see, what places where we feel we're capable of tolerating or not tolerating. Yeah.
Well, I can talk a little bit about my early days as well, and maybe what led me on a path of some form of resistance to the same kinds of things that Terry was talking about. I grew up in Los Angeles as an only child, and I think that and my mother was quite poor and also suffered from mental illness. When I was about, I don't know, 11 or 12 years old, she got pregnant from somebody and was going to have, it would have been a half-sister of mine. And she found out the child had Down syndrome and made a very difficult choice to abort the child. And because of her religious beliefs, being a Catholic, I mean, it triggered very serious mental illness and guilt that plagued her for the rest of her life. And I think that, and it turned her also into a much more fanatic Catholic. So, being an only child who was already kind of on my own in a sense, and then seeing what was happening to my mom as a result of this, it made me extremely critical of these kinds of organized religion and social structures and the kinds of layers of guilt that are imposed on people and that control them. I always thought of my mother as being a really loving and creative person, but because of all of these layers of crap on top of her and also a difficult childhood, as well, she was never given the kind of space to explore that side of herself. And you know, I think I set out to kind of do something different and get outside of that. But she was trapped in that for her whole life, and it was very sad. I mean, she never forgave herself for that abortion, and it sent her into a never-ending spiral, you know, until the end of her life. So I think that was a very powerful thing to experience, and definitely it's what led me as a teenager to kind of start exploring the most extreme fringe cultural scenes that I could find, you know. So, you know, getting into punk and then noise music and fetish stuff, and just trying to find like what is the most extreme reactionary like stuff that seems like it exists outside of this dominant world. I was definitely seeking something that could provide some counterpart that was against what was going on. Of course, I think those things that seem extreme at the time eventually can become co-opted into the same system as well. I have a slight, maybe internal conflict in the sense of having a deep appreciation for traditions as well, and trying to reconcile that with my need to sort of be critical and my need to stand outside or against the system. Because at the same time, like, for example, I have a real soft spot for like certain Mozart pieces, and I'm playing the piano and it's like, wow, I love like the intricacies of this music and the tonal movements and stuff. And at the same time, I'm like, but this represents like the complete oppression of music, musical culture at the same time. So I try to sort of stand inside and outside at the same time. And I think there's something maybe valuable to that, but I don't think that conflict is ever entirely resolved, which maybe is a good thing. I don't know. Yeah, I think that I try to exist in some space that always provides some kind of a comment or a critique to the sort of dominant view of reality, I guess.
That's wonderful, and I guess
I just have to say though, Valerie, that if we're going to have a podcast about pessimism, and you hear that kind of story, and then you respond with "That's wonderful," that shows the entrenched forced optimism that we are like always clinging. So I just wanted to bring that out, not as a criticism, but as a point of reference to how insidious optimism is. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that you remarked that, Terry, because wonderful. The reason why I said wonderful was only with reference to the sincere, candid, confessional manner in which
I understand. You're rewarding it in a very Catholic way. I was also raised Catholic. So yes, I understand this. You're rewarding the confession. I'm giving him a hard time, of course.
Yeah. But just to mention, because I wasn't raised Catholic, I feel very lucky that, in a sense, that my mother didn't become a fanatic Catholic until I was already, I had kind of generated my own sense of myself. So she actually did, she didn't try very hard, but she did try to kind of convert me when I was a teenager. And I almost did get baptized, because I wasn't baptized because my father is Jewish. And so they decided not to baptize me, even though my mother was Catholic. But I almost agreed to be baptized when I was like 13. And then I kind of was like, what the hell am I doing? I feel fortunate that I didn't have that pushed on me at a very young age, so I didn't have to work so hard to shed the layers, you know.
Well, I felt, you know, I felt blessed for your response.
God. And here I am saying,
optimistic.
God. Yeah.
That is more. That is it. that is a transcendental. That is a transcendental optimism. It's really strong. It's really, really serious drug. Yeah.
Was this supposed to be about music?
Yes, 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 yes.
We talked about Mozart. You and your fucking Mozart. We already talked about it.
Well, that's enough for tonight.
Good night. Good night. No.
Is there a link between pessimism and music and music composition? Some philosophers in the past, like Arthur Schopenhauer, did try to establish this connection. I don't know, and it would be a very difficult topic to unpack, but we can always try to illustrate. Here's one of my personal favorites, a Chicago-based artist, Lightyears, and a recording from his album 2236 Wentworth Avenue, released on a Berlin label, Avian. The recording is called 09152015-1822-001. Repetition, little compositional development, minimal rhythm and sounds allow us to expect little, to expect no climax and elevation, no verse, no chorus. Also a recording offering quite curious compositional affinities. You will find it on the album The Pearl, released in 1984 on EG Editions, the album by Brian Eno and Harold Budd, who recently passed away. Some things should not be discussed and instead just appreciated. And this track is called Lost in the Humming Air.
I don't consciously attempt to embody pessimism in the music I create. I think for me it's more about trying to create a state that it inspires a kind of a questioning or interrogation, which is sort of related, I guess you could say, is related to this pessimistic view, which is about trying to sort of stand outside and criticize what's going on. But I think my stance is maybe more ambiguous than Terry's, in that I want it to be a sort of an open question. And so, and I'm interested in embodying sort of what we think of as opposite or conflicting ideas and seeing how they can be intertwined. So that's interesting to me. So that's why I wouldn't say that I try to embody pessimism, but I try to create some kind of a delicate conflict that draws you into it. So there is a sense of, I am drawn to this idea of creating a type of discomfort, but a seductive discomfort. So somehow, yeah, weaving together pleasure and pain, comfort, discomfort, optimism, pessimism, and things like that. So it's, but it's something that still somehow is pleasurable, even if it can be on the edge, on the verge of being painful at the same time.
Here's a track by Eras called Columns from the album Hymn to Moisture, released in 2019 on Seth's label Aw.
So there's a seduction there.
Could I actually ask Seth real quick about how are you using the term embodiment?
I think I'm thinking of it in terms of the creating experiences, like translating some idea into an experience, in a sense, or idea or concept or shape or color or feeling into a sort of human experience, I suppose, through sound.
So for your model, is that something that then you believe can be a kind of constant that is communicated to, like, it's about like sharing an experience of your own with other people in similar way, or is it or how does the kind of inherent misinterpretation and confusion that comes out of any kind of communication, I guess, is it something that you see as like kind of in a humanist sense as a shared experience thing, or is it, or how do you take into account for like misinterpretation or
misinterpreting the listening experience?
Like, is it part of your strategy that the thing that you're embodying will be shared by others, felt by others, I guess? Is that something that is transmissible in a kind of predictable way?
In a sense, but I wouldn't say in a predictable way, because what I try and do is I do try to experience the sound and music that I create. If the sound creates a kind of, if the experience for me is something that creates a kind of a tension between these different feelings, then yes, I want that to be shared. But the thing that's being shared is not fixed, if that makes sense. Like, I want to share this experience of sort of conflict and tension between sort of opposing types of feelings, so that I'm trying to share something that isn't fixed, in a sense, if that makes sense. It's not going to be completely open-ended. Obviously, it's drawing on a pool of types of experiences, but it's sort of like each, and there are obviously going to be areas that I gravitate towards for whatever reason, or certain types of feelings that might recur. But I mean, what I'm trying to achieve is create that kind of tension between the different feelings that might feel somewhat in conflict. I do like this idea of an experience which is pleasurable, but not in a way that you can completely understand. So it's pleasurable, but makes you question that pleasure. It makes you question that experience somehow.
Like, not pleasurable in the super literal way that like Elton John tries to convey, like hit you over the head with narrative lyrics in a Disney film soundtrack.
Right. I mean, most...
It's in opposition to that model. Right?
Exactly. So, most popular music does try to create pleasure in a very specific way and communicate in a very specific way. So, I like to think of it as kind of, it's like opening a window into something, and I like the idea that the thing that I'm putting out there has a kind of life of its own, that it's not just like I thought of something I wanted to communicate and then I turn it into sound and I'm communicating that thing. It's like I kind of gave birth to a thing that, based on how it comes in contact with other people, and it takes on a life of its own, and it may not, I think of it as not being fixed. Even if I've created a piece of music that is a recording that in a sense is fixed, that it has a life of its own, that the elements can be experienced in different ways, in different contexts, by different people.
My approach towards producing media is so very different from Seth's that maybe it's good it's almost like a counterpoint, because in my production, I take for granted that affect, or like emotional responses and those sorts of things, will just happen as a byproduct of human experience. So I try to focus more on like all these metaphors of creativity, creating and birthing and life of, you know, a project having a life, etc. These are things that I specifically try to leave out of the language that I generate around my work. And a part of that, of course, is like a critical rejection of the kinds of contemporary music journalism, and also which is so saturated with public relations, like PR language as well. So my whole thing is kind of like, I was someone that was very influenced by art criticism in the early 20th century, and specifically like a constructivism and things like that. And, you know, I think that we're really missing that kind of critical framework for really looking at the social functions and workings of sound. We have a lot of language that ties it to either affect or creativity and things, or a kind of universal human condition. But the kind of skepticism of what it, kind of skepticism towards authorship and originality and authenticity in an era of rampant replication and tape copies and stuff. I mean, this for me is what's interesting. So that's why, like, you know, as a sample-based producer, it's just from that point forward, it's all about like starting from a point of inauthenticity, of referentiality, and all that sort of stuff. So I just wanted to say, like, you know, like, I'm kind of coming from a completely opposite kind of vector.
Check out this recording by Terry Thamlitz, first released in 1998 on the Frankfurt label Mille Plateaux, named after a famous book by Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari. The recording is called What is Between Missing?
To be a man tomorrow if you wanted to any more than I could.
My son chose to be the way he was. My daughter tells me she was.
Wait. Society would accept me in a pair of jeans, and yes, would not accept his daughter in a skirt.
It's a social problem. It's really a social problem. Gender is what's between your ears, not between your legs. They come into
not
the world. Gender's what's between your ears, not between your legs. It's really a
How many people in the world or in our country are transgender? How many people in our world are gay?
The Europeans don't do this. They're very damaged by that kind of taunting and teasing. This is the only group of people it's politically correct to mock. There is no protection for these people under the Americans for Disabilities
Act. It is not correct to mock someone for their race. It is not correct to mock someone for their religion.
But you can't.
It is not correct to mock someone who is for their sexuality. We have this one last group and we're taken out after them.
These people are treated with dignity. They're protected under the law. Our society tortures these children, and it's especially painful for the children. This is not about sexuality. This is about gender. Gender is not something we decide. You couldn't decide to be a man tomorrow if you wanted to any more than I could.
But it's society would accept me in a pair of jeans and would not accept Ramona's daughter in a skirt.
My son chose to be the way he was. My daughter tells me she's bisexual.
Wait, stop.
I have no problem doing what I need to do to make myself comfortable. If every night you could wake up tomorrow with amnesia. It's really a social problem. As a society, we have to educate ourselves about the real nature of this condition. It's especially painful for the children.
What percentage? Give me a percentage.
3 to 5%. That's quite high when you think about it.
This is a little drop in the ocean of trying to understand our sexuality, the way our mind works, and each other. If you would like to talk about this, well, we'll be right there on the website.
And that's also in my skepticism towards the ability of people of an audience to get my intent is also why my projects tend to come with very elaborate texts. They come also with like videos and other layers that on the one hand try to spell things out for people, but on the other, but trying to do it in a non-authoritarian way, in a way that also kind of collapses on itself and can cause frustration and kind of break the kind of ideological expectation of communalism that people usually bring to music, especially to live performances.
In response to Terry, too, is that although I think there is a certain contrast in our approaches, that when I use the metaphor, I did use this metaphor of birthing something, but I didn't. I do retain the same kind of skepticism of authorship. And so when I say birthing something, it's not a way to give myself credit for that thing, which I guess does happen, and maybe I should use a different metaphor. But the idea is that the thing that I've so-called created, like, lives outside of myself. So I don't consider it as something that comes sort of from my creativity and intellect, but it's like a thing that I observe and interact with, and then it kind of lives out in the world. So I think I try to maintain a kind of critical stance on this idea of like the artist creating the brilliant work through the...
Yeah, I mean, clearly from your project name too, coming from the Duchamp and stuff too.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess like the, you know, like a kind of different language than art having a life of its own or something like that, which is also a very kind of problematic modernist trap, would be the idea of just understanding that its use values change based on how and where it's distributed and received and things like that, and that those are beyond the control and intent of the stage of production oftentimes, and that kind of creates a kind of an open-endedness for how things can be utilized or used. Just kind of maybe like, instead of, for me, I kind of always try to find ways to position that conventional, more traditional model of saying something has a life of its own in relation to use values, and in relation to like a language of use value and a language of context and site specificity, is maybe like something to ground it socially rather than to kind of, by embodying the work with life, then that again is kind of like leading into a kind of ideological area that that, from my understanding of your work, is that probably that you wouldn't be so comfortable, that you'd maybe prefer not inhabiting.
Well, I find that I don't want to reduce the work to use value in that sense. That I do like to think in terms of like metaphors of organic matter, and that sound can be a kind of a being, not in the sense.
And you understand that when I say use value, I'm not it's not a singular thing. It's something that also changes based on context and based on, so like, you know, a track has a specific use value in the ballroom scene and a different use value on the radio and a different use value at a German predominantly straight music festival, or, you know, like, so the use value isn't only about a kind of it's not a singular thing, but use value is a kind of umbrella term used towards just basically like the various ways that something takes on meaning in different contexts, I guess.
Sure. I think that addresses it on a certain level, but then there's another level that I find interesting to explore, just in terms of shape and texture. And I think you can keep in mind the level of understanding of how things work that you're prescribing while still sort of discussing the work on another level, more, you know, in terms of how it might resemble a strange kind of creature.
Sure. I think for me, like, that the thing that you're talking about is a byproduct of a specific process of ideological production within a given context. So that's kind of like when I was earlier saying, like, affect, like, I try not to, of course my music has a lot of emotional manipulation going on, and it's not denying emotion, but it's also not it's also understanding that affect is something that is automatically going to arise in different ways out of different contexts. So for me, like, I guess, yeah, I see affect as a byproduct of ideological production, which is a byproduct of the power dynamics in a site. And so that's how, for me, then use value becomes a way to discuss that entire encapsulation that spans from site specificity to the affect byproducts out of a particular type of, you know, like, for example, fans of the type of music that we produce have a particular, they have a particular kind of education in how to interpret that realm of sounds that, for example, maybe like most of our parents would not. And to naturalize that internalization and education of how to react to the kinds of music that we produce or sounds that we produce is, I guess I'm always trying to not take any of that for granted, not take any of that kind of, not allow for that process of naturalization to go unnoticed, I guess. That's what I'm always struggling for, I guess. So that's why I'm trying to be fussy. For example, like in the performances of my piece called Soulnessless, the video is very text heavy and it's very timed out. It's actually based on a cult initiation film structure, where you're kind of the pacing of the music, every 20 seconds there's a rotation of content and sound and visuals and text, and as it goes through the four sections of the piece, in the final section it's kind of like the video game is leveled up, where like then there are two texts going simultaneously, and what you end up with at the end of the performance is that you're guaranteed that the audience is divided into at least four different groups. One who followed the story up through the top half of the screen, one who followed it through the bottom half only. Then there's the people who tried to follow both but kind of ended up missing things. And then there's the people who were just like, fuck it, just give up. And so the idea is that by the end of the show, everybody knows that they've experienced, like, what they got out of it, what they were able to read and follow, is likely different from the person next to them. And that is a way of kind of literally breaking the communalism. And then from that point, having like I usually have then like a Q&A session and see if like the actual kind of, if a kind of discussion is even possible. Like, so positing the gesture of like breaking the gesture of communalism that people always presume, and then seeing if it's actually capable, if the audience is actually capable of having a discussion that could be meaningful and have some kind of connectivity or not.
One of my projects is to write music for a automated piano. So this is a project under my given name. So I've composed music for an automated piano that is sort of somewhat mathematical in its approach, but it's very intuitive at the same time. But as a performance, I put the piano on stage as sort of a performer. So
here's an example from Seth's 8 studies for automatic piano released in 2011 on Richard Chartier's Line. This one is called Octaves Systematically Filled and Folded, study number 1. Thank you.
when I start the performance, I kind of come up onto the stage just to press a button on the piano and then go sit in the audience. And then the piano sits on stage playing for the audience. So that does inspire a lot of tension and interesting sort of reactions to like what it means to be sitting in the performance space, what's on stage, what is the performer, and what does it mean to have live music. That's an area that is interesting to me, to question the liveness of a musical space. So that's a sort of direct interrogation of that.
No, it's wonderful. I wanted to say one.
Wonderful.
I wanted to say one. I will.
See how fucking hard it is to get.
It just comes.
It's
to my
really
mind,
hard.
But I just.
It's really, really
you
hard.
Just, Valerie, you should just train yourself to respond by saying, "That's awful," instead of that.
Yeah,
terrible.
Or just like, maybe just a.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things I can be pessimistic about, but my life journey overall, like. You know, I'm just grateful for the kind of life I've had, and often
whatever,
and sometimes I just respond in this way. Like I feel things are wonderful.
I feel you, Valerie.
I of course
I have those experiences too.
I do, and I do too.